I've been walking a tightrope between fact and fiction. Been wrestling with demons in small bottled prisons. Been talking to sinners who claim to be Christian, but shouting at leaders who claim to be listening. And the pendulum swings, but I can't stop the pull. Our elections are travesties, paid for in full by a gang full of sellouts who worship a bull. Why can't it all just be free and equal?
Hi, my name is Christina Tobin with the Free and Equal Network, and I wanted to introduce to you guys today, we have Cindy Sheehan. She's a peace and social justice activist, and I met her back in actually 2008 with Ralph Nader when we did a Open the Debates rally. Wonderful lady, so real, so pure. She's been writing so many books. She's on her seventh book today. That is called I Left My Marbles in San Francisco, The Scandal of the Federal Electoral Politics. There's so much Cindy has done. And so, Cindy, welcome to our show today on the Free and Equal Network.
Oh, thank you, Christina. It's really great to talk to you. I always like chatting with you and meeting up with you either on phone or in person. So it's always good to connect.
It's really easy. It's a little harder to introduce you because you've done so many things. And I mean, you're really on the radar. I know you recently did a trip across country, and I was hoping you could tell our listeners a little bit really about who you are and what you stand for those who just have no idea who Cindy Sheehan is, and just give them an overall feel of what you're about and where you came from and so on.
Well, thank you. My son, Casey, was killed in Iraq. He was in the U.S. Army. He was killed on April 4th, 2004. And it's coming up on the 10th anniversary of his death, which sometimes to me it seems like it's only been, you know, 10 months ago. And sometimes it seems like 100 years. So much has happened, but the time has gone by so fast. And he and our family, we were always against the wars, and we were against George Bush and the direction that the U.S. took after 9/11. And so I didn't feel like I had much of a voice in that, against the wars. And that's a problem in our country, is that we feel that because we're told that one person can't make a difference, that, you know, not only are we told that our voices don't matter, but we're conditioned to think that way, to think that, you know, that all the solutions lie in Washington, D.C. or in Sacramento, where they don't. They lie in our communities and in our solidarity with each other. But anyway, after Casey was killed, I had a lot of time on my hands to try and make connections, to tell people how awful losing a child in war is. And I don't even like that euphemism, losing a child. I didn't lose him. If I lost him, I could find him. But so anyway, I made those connections, and then a little over a year after Casey was killed, I ended up camping in a ditch in Crawford, Texas, where George Bush had a vacation home, demanding to know what noble cause killed my son. And so from that beginnings being anti-war and anti-Bush, I've become anti-empire, and that means if you're anti-empire, that means that you cannot support the Democratic Party. So I left the Democratic Party. I've run for office now. I'm on my third campaign, and I don't run against Republicans, really. I run because people on my side of, if there's one line dividing us politically, which we know there's not, people on my side know that the Republicans are full of you know what. But I have to, I feel like part of my mission is to expose the hypocrisy of the Democratic Party also. So You know, and that has evolved into wider issues of social justice, ending the prison industrial complex, ending criminalization of, you know, the drug war. You know, there's so many aspects to this. There's so many dots to connect. And that's one of the reasons I run for political office. It's one of the times that we can connect all those dots. So basically, that's where I am today, running for governor of California. And you did mention my bike ride across the United States, Tour de Peace. This past, from April to July, I was pedaling across the United States, and we stopped in dozens of communities talking about these issues. And once in a while, I'll be like feeling really overwhelmed with what's happening. And I'll think, lady, you know what? You just rode your bike across the United States. You can do anything.
Yeah. You, I was very inspired to see that, and quite a bit over the news and newspapers, because I have you on my Google alerts, knowing what's going on with Cindy Sheehan, and and you know, it really hit me when you said you're anti-empire, that is, and it seems you're really pro-peace and everything that you stand for. Yes. And you are such a, the media, I feel, has really misportrayed a lot of our leaders, like Ralph Nader, you know, as being one way, and Ron Paul another, and uh-huh. even yourself in the past. And, you know, they make individuals out to be what they aren't. And what you are, I feel, is a peaceful individual that has a positive message. And, you know, being anti-democratic as well, it seems like, you know, we're really in this movement anti-two-party system, you know, and seeing the party system as a tool, you know, that the elite families use to intentionally divide us, create needless chaos, and then what happened to your son, you know, it needs to stop, you know, for so many other families that, you know, could be losing their children in the future. And so, you know, on that note, a story you told me a long time ago, years ago, and I don't know why it really strikes me, was when you met President Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit more about that, on your son, and really how these leaders are in person, and just how disconnected they are, you know, from the everyday citizens, Americans, taxpayers, whatnot. I would just love to hear that story, if possible.
Well, you know, I'll tell the story about meeting George Bush if I can follow up in my quest to highlight the hypocrisy of the Democratic Party. Also, if I can follow that up with my meeting with Barack Obama. So if I can tell you about both meetings, because they were pretty similar.
Please do.
Pretty similar in tenor and in atmosphere. So it was June. It was like June, middle of June, that right after Casey was killed, in April, that we got a phone call from, I think it was somebody in the Army, called us and asked us to, if we would go up to Washington State, to Fort Irwin, to have a sit down with President Bush, he said. And so we were like, why? And they wanted us to, he was going to Fort Irwin to talk to the troops. And Fort Irwin is where the Stryker Brigade was from. And we know the Stryker Brigade had a lot of problems with that vehicle. It was, you know, very problematic, caused many deaths. But I think that was after our meeting. Those things were exposed. But anyway, there were about 20 families from our region, which is Northern California, Oregon and Washington state, that were invited to this meeting, families that had lost kids in the war. And I keep saying that, families who had loved ones murdered by the empire in the war in Iraq. And so my entire family went, Casey's dad, who was my husband at the time, our other three children, who were adults, Carly, Andy, and Jane, and we went up to Washington State to meet with George Bush. And we were sitting in this room waiting for him, and he walked in, and the first thing he said was, "So who are we honoring here?" And he didn't even know Casey's name. He didn't even know our names. You know, nobody said, you know, you would think that they would say, you know, President Bush, this is the Sheehan family. Their son, Casey, was their son and brother, Casey, was killed in Iraq. They didn't even say that. And so anyway, we tried to show him pictures of Casey and talk about Casey, but he didn't want to hear anything about that. And he came, he shook my daughter's hand, and he said, "I'm sorry for your loss." And Carly said, "I am too." And he goes, "I'm sure you are." And turned his back on her. And he kept on calling me mom the entire time. And he said, I can't imagine losing a loved one, whether it be, you know, a niece or a nephew or a husband or a wife. And I just stopped him. I said, "It was my son, Casey." He said, "You have children. Try and imagine if one of them was killed." He goes, I said, "Trust me, you don't want to go there." He goes, "You're right, I don't." And so it was just a really weird kind of thing. We were left feeling very discombobulated about what the heck were we doing there and what was this meeting about. And we had decided as a family we would not use this time to express our opposition. We wanted to use the time to personalize Casey to George Bush, but he didn't want to hear any of that personalization. And so then that was our meeting with George Bush in 2004. And 2005, I became a cause celeb for the so-called left in this country. And every Democrat on Capitol Hill wanted to meet with me after Camp Casey. And so I met with people like Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton, which is another story since she might be running for president. Well, she is running for president in 2016. You know, Harry Reid, all of the leading Democratic politicians I met with. And so I met with Barack Obama, who was a senator at the time. And all these meetings, we would have the congressperson staff, my supporters, you know, particularly my sister Dee Dee, who's, you know, usually always with me. We would all meet together in their large, like, reception rooms and chat about these issues. And, of course, the Democrats were generally supportive. They were, you know, saying that if I helped them at least get the House of Representatives back in 2006, that they would help me end the war. And of course, we know that that was a huge lie and a huge betrayal of the anti-war movement. But anyway, for the meeting with Senator Barack Obama, I was told that it would just be he and I. There would be none of his staff, none of my supporters, and no press. And so I was like, yeah, whatever. Who the heck are you? But anyway, I went into his office, and the first thing he did was criticize me for the way I was dressed, because I was wearing my usual capris and protest t-shirt, like I always do. And he said, "How do you come to a meeting with a U.S. senator dressed like that?" And I said, "How do you come to a meeting with a U.S. anti-war activist dressed like that?" And I wasn't going to let him intimidate me. Or, like, I don't really, it's like amazing to me that these people put themselves up above us when they actually are supposed to work for us. And after that, I don't remember much about the meeting, except Barack Obama is just as arrogant and detached from reality as George Bush.
And we'll save the meeting with Hillary, your correspondence with Hillary Clinton, for the next interview, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, Hillary and I have quite a history together, so that would be an interesting chat since, you know, she's already being elevated as the progressive alternative, which to me is absolutely ridiculous. Hillary Clinton, as much a proponent and supporter of and tool of empire as any of the males, Democrat, Republican, or whatever.
Same, same, but different. She's female. That's about it. So
she has a the female characteristics, I guess, but on the outside, but on the inside, I'm not exactly sure.
Well, I think fortunately, you know, I want to spin this interview in more of a solution-based, positive direction. You know, it's just important for listeners because there's not many people that have actually had a sit-down, you know, or discussion with both Bush and Obama. I can't think of anyone offhand who has had that sort of correspondence. So I just thought it was very interesting to see the parallel between, you know, two prominent leaders and seeing whether they're Democrat, Republican. There's just really no difference. There really isn't. I mean, they're both controlled by the same money and they work together, you know, from within. I mean, you know, I am a big believer in Republicans and Democrats, you know, really do like each other, no matter what anyone says. So,
exactly.
And, you know, on that note, let's talk about what you've done to help make the world a better place. That's like a whole nother long, long interview, but you know, books that you've written, want to talk a little bit more maybe about what your tour was about and of course why you ran for office. I see you've written 7 books. Your most recent book is I Left My Marbles in San Francisco, The Scandal of the Federal Electoral Politics. I mean, that is right up the alley of Free and Equal Elections. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? And we definitely plan on selling your work through our store in the near future.
Awesome. Well, Christina, you know as well as anybody, you know as well as anybody the obstacles, the barriers that are put up against people like myself or Ralph Nader or Cynthia McKinney, who step outside of this two-party scandal and really want to affect true and positive, and it really, you know, is revolutionary change. Even you know, even Ron Paul, even though he is in the Republican Party, you know, the one thing we have in common is being anti-empire. So we know all of if you're a member of the Democrats or Republicans and you're outside of that, like, you know, Dennis Kucinich is in the Democratic Party for the most part, but not completely, is that these, if that happens, then they will demonize you in the press or ignore you or make you look like you're crazy if you're not part of the status quo, the dominant paradigm. But there's other obstacles, you know, for like free and equal struggles to get equality in the debates. And voices like mine and Ralph Nader's are shut out of the debates. They don't want people hearing an alternative to the dominant paradigm. And so the last time I think we ever saw anybody being effective in a debate against the Democrats and Republicans was Ross Perot. And, you know, even though he has a lot of faults, he really made the two-party system look ridiculous. And so I have to give him that much. And I think he really put a stop to having anybody else's voices in a national debate. And so that's one obstacle they put up against us. I think that if a candidate is qualified to run for office, that there should be mandatory debates with all of the qualified candidates. Even when I ran against Pelosi, a lot of people in San Francisco were saying, we want to see you and Pelosi in a debate. I said, but if there's a debate, we have to include all of the candidates because I'm not going to be in an exclusive debate. Even though I wanted to desperately debate her, I wasn't going to be in one that excluded. But anyway, she wouldn't debate us anyway. She wouldn't even answer my campaign that had qualified for ballot access, that she wouldn't answer us about a debate. The money issue, you know, Democrats and Republicans that are part of the system have this incredible cash cow that they just seems like they can milk it and have millions of dollars for their campaign. I've lost track about how much Jerry Brown has raised for his campaign. He just had one fundraiser in Los Angeles with Studio Heads that raised $2 million. You know, when people are naive if they think that politicians don't give favors to the people who give millions of dollars to their campaigns. That's what it's all about. You know, I don't know what the solution is to these millions of dollars in campaigns, except to, you know, set limits to level the playing field so our voices can be heard, so people can have a real choice. The biggest problem, I think, is the suppression of third party or independent campaigns, but that people, ordinary people who are struggling just to make ends meet, they don't have the same access to information as other people do. So they get their information from watching maybe 10 minutes of TV every day. And so if campaigns like ours can't break through that, then people don't even know that they have a choice.
I'm definitely with you on the debates issue. That's where we met, actually. I mentioned briefly before the 2008 Open the Debates rally for Ralph Nader. And I remember I was thrown into that after doing the whole national ballot access drive. And they're like, we want you to do the media. And I didn't even know everyone that was going to be there. And I just pulled it all together in literally a day. And I remember meeting you, and that was my first exposure to what you were about and learning about your book at the time, Dear President Bush, and what you stood for. And uh-huh. I became a huge supporter and admirer, really, after I met you, more so than in the moment. And I know Sean Penn spoke at that as well, and Tom Morell of Rage Against the Machine played, and Jesse Ventura spoke at another one, Open Debates Rally. There were two. And so that right there told me, wow, Cindy's the real deal. And you know, when you talked a little bit about money in politics, yes, that's a problem. Parties and money in politics are a problem. And I see that with social media, the internet, technology, and a real movement uniting all these organizations, from the war to drug war, to GMOs, to NDA, to SOPA, election reform, all together. I do see that we the people are going to rise and take our government back, and candidates like yourself will have truly a free and equal chance of winning, because tools will be provided, whether it's being in the debates or, again, that social media side, people on the ground, students helping your campaigns through this mass, positive, powerful, peaceful movement. And I love that you plugged, you know, with third parties and independent campaigns. Yes, you know, it's good to have more parties than two parties, but firsthand I've seen, as a party becomes larger, even the third parties, they inevitably become infiltrated at the top. And that includes both the Libertarian and Green parties. I haven't seen that so much in smaller parties, but as they become larger, it's inevitable parties attract people who want power. And so it does seem like the revolution's going to be not televised, but more so the revolution will be mobilized. And I love the fact that you are setting yourself apart from the rest, because you truly are a jack of all trades, in the sense that you, you know, you've had something not good happen to you, did something about it, and you're just a piece to the puzzle of all these amazing people rising that I feel, and doing what's right, and writing books and running for office. Oh, and let me hop on my bike and travel across country. Who does that? Cindy Sheehan, you know, I'm
in the ditch in Texas in August, really, you know. It's pretty, I'm just open for anything that will collapse the empire. You know, we're even talking in my campaign about having a California secession movement, because, you know, California is a powerful entity. In the right hands, we can really create this revolution that we need. And anything that will bring down this military industrial complex from the bottom up, I think, is something that we should be striving for.
I agree. And I wanted to touch on that point a little bit because you brought it up again, the drug war and the military industrial campaign. I know for our United We Stand festival, we just brought on, for example, Diane Goldstein. She's executive board member for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. She's now a speaker. Mm-hmm. And Students for Sensible Drug Policy is now a sponsor. And, you know, so we're really getting a lot of support on that end. Of course, on the GMO side, Tammy Canal, the founder of March Against Monsanto, a huge variety. So I just think that, wow, I mean, the drug war military-industrial campaign is a huge, huge issue. And I just started reading a book by Balko, Rise of the Warrior Cop. It was given to me by Diane Goldstein a couple days ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, just fascinating that we didn't even have cops 175 years ago. And I mean, I'm literally in the first couple pages here, but can you tell me a little bit more about your stance on that and why it's so important to you?
Well, I like I said, I think that these issues are intricately and intimately connected. You know, the prison industrial complex, Jerry Brown is a big proponent of, you know, mandatory sentencing. We have thousands of people here in California incarcerated for nonviolent marijuana busts. And, you know, the drug war causes a lot of violence, a lot of corruption in police forces and law enforcement. So at least marijuana should be decriminalized. And I see a trend, and this is a grassroots trend, Christina. It certainly isn't from the top down. I see a trend like spreading like wildfire across this country to decriminalize marijuana. You know, it's ridiculous that it's criminalized in the first place. So, you know, there's just so much corruption and cronyism in law enforcement. We see this with, you know, the cops being out of control and murdering people like young Andy Lopez in Santa Rosa. And you know, unfortunately, he's not an isolated incident. It's widespread. And what happens with these cops is they're not held accountable because they're supposed to police, you know, if you want to use that word, police themselves and hold themselves accountable. And as governor of California, we would end that. We would, you know, institute community boards of accountability on police forces. We would end the, do you know about the police force bill, the law enforcement bill of rights? It gives law enforcement officers more rights than we have. What do you need more than a bill of rights? And they have their own bill of rights that protect them from accountability. So every citizen of a community should be under the same rights and responsibilities as the other citizen, and nobody should be elevated above that.
Thank you so much for informing our listeners about such an important topic, and it definitely has become a huge influence in the sense of being a part of, you know, the United We Stand Fest, Free and Equal, everything we're doing, and educating people about such an important topic. I mean, given but what's
Christina,
going on in Mexico.
One thing that I forgot to mention about that whole issue is the militarization of the police forces, how the communities are accepting federal money to further increase the militarization of the police forces. And that is, for example, the officer that murdered Andy Lopez is a Iraq vet. And so we're seeing the war, the foreign wars being fought more, you know, widespread on our own streets. And the rise of the police state, spying on every citizen, every communication of every citizen, you know, it's going to take a revolution and the collapse of the empire to end these things before it touches it's already touched my family, and it's beginning to be more profound and persistent before it touches your family. And by your, I mean anybody that's listening to that will listen to this show. Before it touches your family, we have to work together to stop it. But we have to realize that we're all part of the human family, and we've all already been harmed.
Well, Cindy, I mean, on that note, I do see a light at the end of the tunnel that's getting brighter every day. It seems internationally, countries are seeing that our system, drug war, the militarization of America's police forces, it's just not being accepted. I see in the international media and even amongst our Americans and our citizens, we are waking up a bit and more quickly every day, you know, each passing day. And I do foresee that we will rise and recognizing that there are far more of us than there are of them. There are a dozen or so powerful families that use tools like the two-party system, the Commission on Presidential Debates, the mainstream media, you know, that are all tied into the power of AIPAC and Israel. I mean, it's all very obvious that we have been played by the system, by a few powerful families that control us, the Rockefeller, Rothschilds. And so instead of pointing fingers of all the problem, my philosophy is let's just fix it. And I mean, we're really not a force to be reckoned with, the youth that will be rising. And I wanted to briefly end on that note of you're one of our awesome speakers at the United We Stand Festival. It's a kickoff for a 10-stop university bus tour on May 10th at UCLA Poly's Pavilion. It holds over 10,000 people. I want to thank you so much for being a part of that, Cindy.
Well, thank you. I went to UCLA and I actually had a couple of finals in the Poly Pavilion. So it will be great. It'll be great to be there and to really this revolution that we need, Christina, it has to be diverse. It has to be, you know, the young, the old, the middle, the black, white, red, brown, yellow, gay, straight, male, female, whatever. We have to have a very diverse revolution to be successful. It can't look like another elitist situation. So we have to welcome this diversity. And I'm very excited to be part of our struggle.
I feel so honored to have you there, Cindy. All the stuff that you do aside, I find you as a person to be just extraordinary sitting down with you. I remember at UW-Madison when you came out there to speak on a panel with a writer of The American Conservative and Angela Keaton of Antiwar.com and Sean Scallon and Teresa Motto, the former campaign manager for Ralph Nader, 2000-2004. And that's when I felt like I really connected with you. I'm like, this lady is in it for the long haul. She's, you know, not going anywhere. So
I think so we have to pace ourselves.
Yeah, it's definitely a marathon, and no one can say it better than you. Marathon. For all of our listeners, please check out Cindy. She's running for governor of California under the Peace and Freedom Party line, though I do see her, as well as Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, as independents. Takes a lot of signatures to run as an independent for statewide office, a lot less to run with a party, but she is running with the Peace and Freedom Party line. You can check her out at Cindy. 2014.org. That's Cindy, C-I-N-D-Y, 2014.org. And she also has an awesome soapbox show, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. She does a lot of interviews there, and you can check her on there. I think it's Cindy Sheehan's soapbox.blogspot.com.
Or you can just get there, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. And if people Google that, and Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.com will get you to the blog spot.
And Cindy, did you have anything else for our listeners before we wrap it up?
No, I think just, you know, check us out at the websites. And my new book, the information on my new book, How to Order, it is at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. I left my marbles in San Francisco.
Wow, and we didn't even touch. I'm looking through here, the voter machine, the election fraud issue is really the heart of like the movement of all these leaders that are, okay, we know these are all the problems we're going to bring together with the festival, but we're going to address the obvious problems of election fraud and voter machine, the need for open source software, and maybe getting rid of the Electoral College, supporting proportional representation. Seems like those are great
all
things.
Yeah, I address all of that stuff, and I left my marbles in San Francisco. And, you know, we need to really look at the model of Venezuela that had 100% clean elections in the last election. And there's a lot we can learn from, you know, different traditions, different cultures that would make ours much better, that's for sure.
Well, thank you, Cindy. I appreciate having you on the show. And so we're going to wrap it up here. Thank you, everybody, for listening to the Free and Equal Network. I'm Christina Tobin, and thank you so much for your time today. Lots of love to all.
Thanks, Christina.
My gang full of sellouts who worship a bull. But why?